Good afternoon. Thank you all so very much for joining us for yet another informative session at the Commonwealth Club. You have been listening to William Barton, one of Australia's most renowned musicians who plays didgeridoo, and I hope I'm saying it right. Didgeridoo is an Aborigines instrument that is made of eucalyptus trunks that have been hollowed by termites. I'm so very pleased to formally introduce William and ask him to play a piece to serenade our distinguished speaker today. William has been playing didgeridoo for over 20 years. He's been working with traditional dance groups, fusion jazz bands, orchestras, string quartets, and mixed ensembles. And he's been touring internationally since the tender age of 15. Please join me in giving a warm San Francisco welcome to William Barton.
desert and every night I dream of the sea. They say home is where you find it. Will this place satisfy me? For I come from so what a people. We always live by the sea. Now I'm out here west of Alice Springs with my wife and a family and my island home, and my island home, and my island home is waiting for me. In the evening the dry wind blows from the hills and across the plains, and I close my eyes and I'm standing in a boat on the sea again, and I'm holding a long turtle spear, and I feel I'm close now to where it must be, a mile home is waiting for me, a mile. My own home, and my own home is waiting for me. And my own home, and my own home, and my own home is waiting for me. Is it waiting for me?
Thank you, everybody.
That was terrific. Let's begin our formal program. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Jale Dai, a proud member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and chair of today's program. I'm deeply honored and thrilled to introduce today's distinguished speaker, the Honorable Anastasia Palaszczuk, Member of Parliament and Premier of Queensland, Australia. Queensland is Australia's second largest state and the third most populous, with more than 4.5 million inhabitants. It also is home to the incredible and one and only Great Barrier Reef. Madam Premier, that must be the most fun part of your job, to preside over that. The Honorable Anastasia Palaszczuk is one of Australia's leading political figures. Today, she'll outline how Queensland is diversifying its economy from a traditional natural resources-centric economy to one that is based on innovation and ideas, as well as talking about the opportunities offered by Queensland as a launchpad for investment in the Asia-Pacific region. Madam Palaszczuk was sworn in as Premier of Queensland in 2015 and has presented the electorate in Queensland Parliament since 2006. She holds Bachelor of Arts and Law degree from University of Queensland and a graduate diploma of legal practice from Australian National University. Please join me in giving a very warm California welcome to the Honorable Anastasia Palaszczuk.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's indeed my honour and privilege to be here today, and can I thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event. To Dr. Gilles Adai, to Jeff Blaish, to Chris Oldfield, our Australian Consul General based here, to guests one and all, and can I also acknowledge our Queensland delegation that is also with us here as well. Well, it's a great privilege to be here addressing you today. And today, of all days, the focus of the nation being on California and tomorrow's presidential primaries. As an elected leader from a foreign nation, it's not my place to commentate on your domestic politics, except to say that this election, more so than any other I can remember, is being watched very closely right around the world. My speech today is all about sharing with you the journey that my state has embarked on, a journey that I hope will culminate in Queensland becoming an innovation powerhouse at the heart of the Asia Pacific. Of course, we're not alone in embracing innovation and the knowledge economy. But us Queenslanders are a unique bunch. We have the natural assets, the world-class thinkers, and the determination to get there. Let me start with some background on Queensland. What we're known for, and what you may not know. We have a population similar to that of South Carolina, about 4.8 million people, in an area 2.5 times the size of Texas. We are a big place, an optimistic place. Historically, Queensland's economic strength has been built on commodity exports. Our coal and bauxite resources are amongst the largest in the world, and we lead Australia in production of metals like zinc, copper, and lead. Over $60 billion has been invested in our natural gas industry, and we are the largest exporter of LNG based on coal seam gas in the world. We are one of the world's largest beef exporters and largest sugar exporters, and we have the potential to be the gourmet food bowl for Asia with a reputation for the highest quality and most trusted produce. And if you know the Great Barrier Reef, you know where Queensland is. Our precious reef, along with the outback and our beaches, is the bedrock of our tourism sector. Recently, we've seen a 20% increase in American visitors just in the last year, a 33% increase in Chinese visitors, over 1 million for the first time. Thousands of new hotel rooms are being built and new aviation routes opening up all the time, and hopefully one to San Francisco in the very near future. But Queenslanders are also innovators. We have fantastic researchers and entrepreneurs always looking for new ways to do things. Queensland innovators lead the world in a number of areas. We developed Gardasil, the first cancer vaccine in the world that now protects young women from 70% of cervical cancers. We provide the high-tech radiators that cool the world's fastest cars, including your Indy cars. We have developed world-first stem cell technology that helped enable a paraplegic to walk. And our game designers made Fruit Ninja, perhaps one of the most popular computer games in the world. In short, we have innovated and we are innovating. But the imperative to innovate has never been greater because our future depends on it. Economically, Queensland has enjoyed a very long period of high economic growth. The Australian dollar has revalued, boosting the competitiveness of our tourism and agricultural sectors. Business confidence in the state is leading our nation. But recent economic events, especially the fall of global commodity prices, has reminded us of the risks of relying on resources alone. So we need to export more than just commodities. We need to be making new markets, not just being at the mercy of existing ones. The forces of disruption are changing business models and delivering new products and services across the world. Just think of the advances in fields such as genomics, advanced materials and 3D printing, autonomous vehicles, artificial intelligence and robotics, and how these will radically change the world that you and I know. Do we seek to hold back those forces to protect existing industries, to block change, to stifle the results of new technology? Or do we embrace change, embrace the possibilities of disruption, foster the uptake of new opportunities to create new business and new jobs? This is a choice between being open or being closed. My government has chosen to embrace the new economy, to embrace change and disruption, to choose opportunity and accept an element of uncertainty and unpredictability. Innovation is the heart of our economic agenda. We look to new ideas as the driver of growth. We will focus on those areas where Queensland possesses a genuine global competitive advantage, where we have domain knowledge, the ability to commercialise that knowledge into products and services, and links to global supply change. Knowledge intensity will be at the heart of these new industries. But what I want to make clear is that embracing the new economy does not mean we abandon the old economy. The digital age does not mean the end of mining, agriculture, or tourism. In fact, quite the opposite. What my government seeks to do is to build on our existing strengths and create new opportunities. We want to harness the new economy to renew the old economy. For example, 60% of the world's mining software is developed in Australia. Safety Culture, a Queensland firm, has developed an app called iAuditor, which is used by mining companies for health and safety. It is now the most used safety audit app in the world and has supported some 20 million audits in over 80 countries. The firm is based in Townsville in North Queensland and now have an office right here in San Francisco. What I understand clearly is that a decision to choose openness, to embrace disruption, creates new challenges. We are engaged in a frank conversation with the community about change and what it means for the economy as a whole, and for the people and their families. As a state government, we are investing in improved service delivery, particularly focusing on those in disadvantage. We want to ensure that we equip all Queenslanders for the economy of the future, and we help people find their way in the new world. We also focused on giving our next generation the skills they need to succeed in this new digital world. And we are focused on giving them the inspiration to make a job, not just take a job. With coding and entrepreneurship now being taught in our schools, coding is actually being taught at the primary school level, so that's at age 5. With young starters, entrepreneurship programs rolling out across our state, we are giving our future generations a chance to succeed in this new world. And indeed, the fusion of the future and fairness is being innovative in service delivery, in opening up the government to the new economy to deliver better results. We intend to practice what we preach. An example is when people turn 65 in Queensland, they are entitled to a whole range of concessions. By innovating using digital platforms and new models of delivery, we have reduced the waiting time it takes for a citizen to around 5 hours, down from a potential 20 days under the traditional approach, and we are still pushing to reduce that time even more. The fundamental point here is that by embracing both innovation and inclusion, we are better able to achieve our ambition. The alternative, in my view, is the road backwards. It is the road to protection, to isolation, which in fact does not protect, because no one can be isolated in this world. Queenslanders, like Americans, are fundamentally optimistic. I want to harness that optimism to make the transition to a knowledge-based economy, and this is at the heart of my innovation agenda. We have invested $180 million to date in Advance Queensland, and we will expand this investment soon, next week, in our budget. Our success will be not only about the scale of our investment, but about our approach. I spent 3 years as opposition leader in Queensland thinking about our state's future, talking to business people, entrepreneurs, researchers, thinkers in Australia and elsewhere, and working on a program of action. In the age of the 24-hour news cycle, we have taken the time to consult and collaborate to get this policy right. And I might just comment that when I was opposition leader, we were reduced to 7 members of the Queensland Parliament out of a total of 89 seats. We then won 2 by-elections. The first by-election was Redcliffe, where at the time in opposition, we achieved an 18% swing. And then the Stafford by-election, where we achieved a swing of nearly 20%. And at the election, when I was elected as Premier, from 9 seats, we secured 44 seats, plus the support of the Independent to be able to achieve government. And I might just add as well that I'm very proud that the government that I lead has 50% women in our cabinet. And I think that's quite a remarkable achievement. Let's hope that that becomes the new norm across the world. We have unashamedly looked around the world for inspiration as well, for models to adopt and to adapt to Queensland. We understand that we need to build linkages to the rest of the world to learn and to grow in a global context. So we've expanded a program of visiting entrepreneurs. We are bringing teams of our brightest entrepreneurs here to Silicon Valley to learn from the heart of the new economy. And we have mirrored a Chilean program to recruit aspiring startups from around the world to come to Queensland, develop their products in our state, and enrich our ecosystem. What my government understands clearly is that it is the private sector, entrepreneurs and businesses large and small, that are the engine room of the new economy and growth. We seek to foster innovation through collaboration. For me, government is an enabling platform for innovation, to connect innovators, to help them learn and grow, to foster investment, and perhaps to provide some inspiration. And like all governments, I expect my government to be a key customer for innovation. Friends, states were once described by your Supreme Court as the laboratories of democracy. That is because they can experiment, try new things, and pivot if they need. This is the same kind of thinking that startups adopt. That's the approach we're adopting with our programs. While we have a clear strategic intent, we understand that developing the right solution requires experimentation. We aim to be agile. We develop our programs through co-design with industry and the community. And we are willing to change, even if this means admitting we didn't get it right the first time. Sometimes this is hard to do. It's not a case of fail fast, it's a case of learn fast. Your culture here with Silicon Valley just down the road has made an art form of this. In my state, it's yet to catch on, but the reality is we need to be willing to try something else, to reinvest if something isn't getting results. Let me give you an example of our innovation agenda, which we call Advance Queensland in Action. We have existing strength in agriculture. We have research strengths in life sciences. We are building a new opportunity for these strengths in biofutures. Yesterday, I launched the Queensland Biofutures 10-year roadmap, setting out our long-term strategic intent to achieve a $700 million US export-orientated industrial biotech sector by 2025. We have built this on the back of extensive consultation with industry, the research community, and global consumers of biofutures products. We are taking a global approach, targeting a slice of worldwide demand expected to top $1 trillion US by 2022. And partnerships between the public and private sector will be at the heart of our efforts. The primary purpose of my trip to California is to showcase Queensland life sciences opportunities at the Bio26 conference and to deepen our relationships with the US partners, of whom we are paving the way forward. A range of our universities and institutions are providing leading R&D on advanced biofuels and biofutures in general. Biofuels is of particular interest to us and to you. As you are aware, Australia and the US have been partners in war and peace for many decades. In fact, my state's capital city, Brisbane, is the birthplace of the US Navy's mighty 7th Fleet, created during World War II for service in the Pacific. On Friday, I had the deep honour of meeting Vice Admiral Nora Tyson, commander of the 3rd Fleet in San Diego. As the US Navy's Green Fleet Initiative continues to utilise biofuels into its energy mix, they realise Queensland is a natural partner. Our abundance of sugarcane and other feedstocks, as well as our strategic geographic location, ticks all the boxes for the US Navy. We've started a pilot project with an advanced refinery that is investigating the use of formerly scorned materials such as bagasse to develop a commercial scale operation expected to produce 200 million litres of fuel per year. It's a partnership I hope will be a catalyst for an entire biofutures industry in Queensland. The possibilities in this area are, of course, immense. Other giants in this field in the US are already working with Queensland. The Joint Bioenergy Institute and their partners have already begun genome mapping sugarcane, as well as Queensland's spotted gum, a relative of the eucalypt tree. And Californian company Amyris and the University of Queensland are working together on the development of molecules that can lead to a range of products from jet fuel to cosmetics to car tyres. We recognise the need to experiment and collaborate if we are to approach biofutures to search for new ways to achieve our goals. We start with the end in mind, then attempt and adapt and evolve until we find a solution. And this is real partnership. We are not afraid to find new ways to achieve our goals and new partners to do it with. As part of our state's commitment to openness and our embrace of change, we are deeply committed to trade as an enabler of growth. The Washington-based Centre for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment sees Australia as a sweet spot, ideally placed to act as a gatekeeper to the Indo-Pacific region. It says that geopolitically, we've shifted from down under to top centre in recent years. The Trans-Pacific Partnership and free trade agreements with Japan, Korea and China are opening doors in increasingly consumption-driven markets like never before. We in Queensland are ideally placed as a launchpad to the Asia-Pacific for firms looking to take advantage of these opportunities. We are in the same region. We are stable. We have a welcoming business environment, a strong research base, a talented workforce, a thriving entrepreneurial scene. And I hope I have outlined to you today there is a government in Queensland that has an ambition and an approach that will succeed in building a knowledge-based economy. Friends, as President Obama noted in his 2014 State of the Union address, we know that the nation that goes all in for innovation today will own the global economy tomorrow. Let me assure you, Queensland is going all in for innovation. And we are confident that we will achieve our ambition of a shift to a knowledge-based economy, to a diversified economy with new industries like biofutures, to an economy at the heart of the booming Asia-Pacific. Today is Queensland Day. This day marks the anniversary of our state taking control of its own destiny in 1859. The journey we are on is about our economic destiny. This is a destiny as part of the global economy embracing change, harnessing entrepreneurial energy, focusing on both the future and fairness. Why don't you come and see for yourself and join us on the journey? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Premier. Anastasia Palaszczuk, the Premier of Queensland, Australia. I'm Jeffrey Bleich, the United States Ambassador to Australia, and I'm your moderator for today's audience question period. And we've got a number of questions, but first, I just hope that you're feeling very welcome here in San Francisco on Queensland Day. We had a didgeridoo player. I've got my kangaroo R.M. Williams boots on. We, you know, in addition to the didgeridoo, we had William Barton, who's one of the most exceptional didgeridoo performers in the world here. And we even rolled out a big blanket of San Francisco fog for you. So, but I hope you're enjoying your second Queensland Day, because I guess it was in Queensland, it was yesterday.
That's right. And everyone can be honorary Queenslanders for the day here. And I must say that our winters are not as cold as your summers. So if ever you want to escape the cold, please come to Queensland for a holiday.
Well, there you mentioned the Great Barrier Reef, and obviously it's very much on our audience's mind as they're sitting here in a cold San Francisco winter planning their vacations. So we have a number of questions about it. The first one is, are you excited about the upcoming Finding Nemo sequel, Dory? And how have those films affected Australia and tourism, in particular in your area up in Queensland?
Oh, well, I look forward to seeing the sequel. But of course, it's movies like that, but also the world's attention when it comes to issues like global warming that places us in a unique position to showcase our amazing Great Barrier Reef. It is truly magnificent, and if anyone has not had the opportunity to come down and see the Great Barrier Reef, please make sure that you do it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And my government is working very closely with the federal government in protecting the Great Barrier Reef. Both our governments have committed $100 million each, and that's to improve the water quality from the runoff of the farms that lead into the Great Barrier Reef catchments. So we've had some coral bleaching of late, and that's a direct result of the fact that we have not had our rain season in the far north of our state. But the reef covers, you know, thousands of kilometres. So when you hear about coral bleaching, it's only on a small section of the reef. It's not in the entire reef.
Well, you had mentioned innovation, and I remember when I was in Australia, they were looking at innovative ways to help protect the reef, including there was one group that was looking at spraying the surface in order to make the light reflect back rather than absorb into the water and heat the temperatures. Are there particular innovations that excite you about that are being performed to help protect the reef?
I think there's the one thing that my government's been very focused on is getting the scientific research right. So we put in place a scientific task force to advise government on how to spend the $90 million. One innovative way we're looking at protecting the reef is where government will match the business community and that funding will go directly into saving the reef. But we're always prepared to listen to the science. The scientists know what's best. But I think clearly it's about working with the farmers in the first instance, and they're using a lot of interesting techniques on their land holdings at the moment to stop that sediment runoff that's going in from the different farms into the reef. And another thing my government did too is we've actually banned the dumping of capital dredge spoil. So if there's an expansion of a port, that dredge spoil can't be dumped on the reef. It has to be dumped onto the land, so you don't have all of that churning into the Great Barrier Reef. So it's little measures like that, but have a huge effect, a huge impact.
There are actually a number of questions about how Australia is adapting to climate change, not only in the Great Barrier Reef, but more generally. And one question goes to whether or not Queensland is focusing on the solar energy and storage technology, particularly given the dominance of China and the USA. What space does Queensland see in that form of innovation?
That's a great question, Jeff, because my government is very focused on having our renewable target of 50% renewables by 2030. We are working extremely hard. We have the most number of solar panels on rooftops by population anywhere in the world. So companies like Tesla are working with my government to see if they can run some trials there. We've got $2 billion worth of private sector investment to develop solar farms right up and down the state. So in that space, we know we have to change, we have to do more, but we need to take the community and the public with us. So I see my role as being a communicator to ensure that the public understands that, you know, we need to do everything we possibly can. And Queensland is such a big state, 2.5 times the size of Texas, and we have people living, you know, in remote communities. So, you know, power becomes a very big issue, and if we can utilise more solar, that will benefit the communities living in remote areas as well.
You know, it's getting a little unfair. You know, spectacular weather, the Great Barrier Reef, unspoiled scenery, and now you're adding to it, you know, Teslas and solar power. So You're here now in San Francisco, and we're very proud of Silicon Valley. What sorts of things have you encountered here that have excited you, that have gotten you fired up and that you want to take back to Queensland?
I think it's very important for leaders of whether it's a state or a country to come and explore what people are doing, because you actually take some of those ideas back with you. So when we were formulating our Advanced Queensland policy, I actually asked some of the people from Brisbane and Australia who actually moved to Silicon Valley, what can I do to get you to come back? And they said you needed to actually facilitate a really strong startup community. And one of the suggestions they made to me, which then I adapted into policy, was that we now have the ability for people living in Queensland to go and work in a company in Silicon Valley to learn the expertise, the management skills, and bring those skills back to Queensland. I always want people to return back to Queensland. And we are attracting people now from different parts of the world to Queensland. I think lifestyle has a very big part to play in that. So there are people who don't want to live in, you know, very large-scale cities, and we have a unique lifestyle. We have you can swim all year round in the beaches and everything, the mountains to the rainforests to the beaches from Brisbane are all within an hour. So it's the most spectacular place, and we're really trying to push that startup community.
Now, I know you said you didn't want to get involved in U.S. politics, but a few people would like you to. I'm going to try and find a gentle entry into this.
Okay.
Because you have your own election coming up now.
That's right.
You've got federal elections coming up in Australia. And it's closely divided. No one knows exactly which party. Divided between Labor and Liberal National Coalition. And yet, we've got some polling back of the popularity of President Obama in Australia, including in Queensland. He has an 87% approval rating. So
I would kill for those approval ratings. Yeah.
No, I think he may be thinking about statehood for you guys. To what would you attribute that? What do you see about things that are being done in U.S. politics that, for whatever reason, seem to interest Australians across the political divide?
I think everyone's always interested in U.S. politics and U.S. elections because every night on our news back home, you know, anything that's happening in the U.S. dominates our world news and is always talked about. And I think what was really significant was during the G20 in Brisbane to have President Obama come and address, make an address at the University of Queensland. I was very fortunate to be there that day. And he was just inspirational. And I think people look for leaders that can inspire and that can unite. And that's always been my philosophy, is to unite and not to divide. And I think where leaders, where the community needs to question leaders is where they seek to divide the community. There is nothing worse than putting one section of the community against another. It's no good for... We've had some experiences about that in the past in Australia, which we didn't like, and I don't think in the United States you'd like to see that as well.
Very, very nicely put. I think you have a career in diplomacy, Madam Premier. You referred to the relationship between the United States and Australia, but particularly with Queensland, as a special one. I remember visiting MacArthur's headquarters in Brisbane, in Queensland. And we have a number of questions about the ongoing security relationship between the United States and Australia. One person in the audience says, you know, could you talk about any lessons that you've learned about dealing with terrorism, the terror threat, given that Australia and the United States have been such close partners in national security, and I'm sure that comes under your jurisdiction, at least with the security of Queensland.
That's, you know, of course, that's a very topical question for everyone. And fortunately, we have not had any incidents in Queensland. And I think the close collaboration with the United States has meant a great exchange of information. The issue, those issues are dealt primarily at the national level, but as a premier, the premiers regularly meet with the prime minister, usually three or four times a year, to discuss issues of national importance. And, you know, we do understand that it is a complex issue. It's a changing world. We've all seen the incidents that have happened on the world stage. And I think it's actually made people more aware that it is a different world that we're living in to one, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And it's a huge challenge for law enforcement agencies with a lot of their work, with the rise of the internet and young people getting involved. It's a real challenge for governments, especially with disengaged young people. And how do we stop them from going down a dangerous path and getting them more focused, definitely more focused on being involved in you know, sport and other social activities. So I think that's something that, you know, my government is giving some due consideration to. We're about to set up a group looking at that in particular, and we've allocated $5 million in the first instance to re-engaging with young people.
Well, there has been a lot of work done between the U.S. and Australia to secure both of our nations, and it has been a long, as you said, security relationship dating back to World War II, and even before then with the Great White Fleet. But there has been some movement within Australia about, you know, concern that the close relationship with the United States might antagonize other partners in the region, and in fact, one of the former prime ministers, Malcolm Fraser, has raised concerns about whether it's in Australia's interest for the U.S. to be able to assume Australia's support in the event of a conflict. Are there? How do you read the situation in terms of the relationship between the United States and Australia? And is there some fraying of the partnership that we've had in security?
I don't believe that there's any fraying of that at all. I think it's a very strong relationship. It's one that I personally value. Both of my trade missions to the United States have been helped coordinated through U.S. Ambassador John Berry and the U.S. Consul General. I think it's a very, very strong relationship, and you know, Queensland's had that long association of having US in Queensland helping us. In fact, my grandmother nearly married so it could have been a very different story, Jeff. She nearly married a US serviceman many, many years ago.
Yep. Well, you know, that's the truest form of partnership. yeah. No, I think the... Well, one of the important things that Australia and the U.S. have done together really directly affects Queensland in that it is freedom of navigation and the sea routes around Queensland. I think one of the reasons why Queensland has been so successful in so many areas, not just in science and technology, but also in the resource sectors, has been, you know, your access to these key trade routes and your tremendous trade that you've developed throughout the Asia-Pacific region. How do you see the advance Queensland effort, you know, continuing to build on that, on the distribution throughout Asia and tying up your relations more closely with Asian neighbors economically?
Yeah, I think there's great opportunities. Like some of Queensland's strongest trading partners have been Japan and China for many years, and South Korea, emerging markets now in Vietnam and India. Queensland's also very fortunate. We've got about 14 trade offices around the world. Most of those trade offices are in the Asia-Pacific region. And there is a lot of opportunities with Advanced Queensland because, as I stated earlier, we're almost like the stepping stone into Asia. So we're encouraging a lot of companies, if they want to do business with Asia, to come and do that through Queensland. And I'm also very conscious that our school system needs to adapt. So we're going to be placing a lot more emphasis on students acquiring an Asian language. That was a very key policy at a national level many years ago, but in practice it hasn't really happened. So there's a lot, going to be a lot more opportunities if people are able to learn those languages being so close and having that shared time zone.
Yeah. Well, the relationship with China is a very important one, and it has been an engine for growth throughout the world, including in your region. But we have one question asking how the current tensions in the South China Sea affect Queensland's prospects, and to the extent that you're involved in the federal discussions on this, the general thinking in Australia about how to preserve this robust trade with China while at the same time navigating the legal requirements of maritime security and freedom of navigation.
It's a very complex question in relation to Southern China Sea, because that's more the domain of the federal government, of which I don't have jurisdiction to. So I'm quite sure that the Prime Minister is giving that due consideration. And just recently, the Prime Minister and a number of premiers, including myself, we had Australia China Week in Shanghai and Beijing. And the purpose of that was to foster good trading relationships, especially in relation to what Queensland is good at, agriculture and the resources sector. So there is a strong appetite for our good coal, but also to our technologies associated with that, and also with renewables. Agriculture is, our exports are up something like $5 billion, which is fantastic. So we will continue to have those strong trading relationships, but at the same time we still need to be very much aware of issues that could potentially cause tensions in that region. But I think I'll leave that for the diplomats to and the Prime Minister to comment on further.
Well, your story about your mother almost marrying an American service member inspired someone in the audience to remind me that even in the most robust security times, there's always been a qualified love of U.S. service members. Apparently, the phrase used in Australia during World War II was overpaid, oversexed, and over here. to refer to... so there you go. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest is the Honorable Anastasia Palaszczuk, Premier of Queensland, Australia, and I'm Jeff Bleich, former United States Ambassador to Australia and your moderator. And you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel. Also encourage people to try the podcast. And that's not even in the notes. Another area, and of course, because this is a San Francisco audience, I always have to ask the tough questions. We've got some fun ones, too. But immigration. Immigration has become a flashpoint issue in our politics. You've got a federal election coming up. Could you tell us the thinking in Australia about immigration issues and how those are playing out, both politically and particularly in your state, which is a destination for many refugees?
I'll probably start with a little bit about my background so you'll understand my viewpoint when it comes to these issues. So my grandparents came out from Poland after the Second World War, so they came with absolutely nothing. So they were migrants. The area that I represent in the Legislative Assembly in Queensland is a very multicultural community. In fact, it's probably one of the most diverse communities. I think there's over 50 different nationalities living together in that community. And a large proportion, the largest proportion of Vietnamese refugees who came out after the Vietnam War live in my electorate. Having said that, it's a challenge for both federal and the opposition about how they deal with issues of immigration. And being a Labor Premier, I believe that we need to increase our humanitarian entry into Australia. I think the whole world has a part to play, and we need to be very welcoming of people fleeing war-torn situations. My grandparents went through it. My grandfather spent 7 years in a work camp. I've recently met with African refugees in my community as well. I spoke to a young woman. She was about 10 years old, and I said to her, how are you finding Brisbane? How are you finding living in Inala? She said, I love it. I said, how long were you in the refugee camp for? She said, 9.5 years. So she had only known freedom in my state. The thing about people coming to a new country, and you know, the United States has a proud record of welcoming migrants, and we have a proud record. You know, Australia would not be what it is today without the migrants and the refugees. We have built a very, very strong and inclusive community where we welcome other cultures and we have tolerance and we have diversity. We have diversity of views and opinions, but we all work together. People coming to the countries, whether it's the United States or to Australia, want the very best for their children. And what you see now is an example from the Vietnamese refugees who are now aging in my community. Their daughters, their grandsons are now our doctors, our pharmacists, our school teachers, you know, our small business owners, and they're helping to drive the economy. So it's about how you welcome communities, and you know, we need to build on the strength. So I hope they can resolve this issue at a federal level.
Well, it sounds like you're going to be building on strengths, and that we shouldn't expect any plans for Queensland to build a big, beautiful wall anytime soon.
What? Although it could be tempting against New South Wales at times. Jeff, you might have missed yeah. recently we had this big debate. Someone wanted to divide Queensland, and I said, no, my main priority is to unite Queensland, not divide Queensland. You always have these interesting issues during federal election campaigns. And then we just said, oh, well, maybe Queensland should expand over the border into New South Wales. And I thought, oh, that would go away, that issue. And what happened was they actually rang some of the mayors and they said, yes, we want to be part of Queensland. Can you make it happen?
So next month, the Commonwealth Club will be hosting the premier of New South Wales for rebuttal. So now what you've talked, you know, I think a lot of people who are listening to the program or watching it are going to want to get visas, particularly after the election, but possibly tourist visas to come and visit Australia.
We're happy to welcome any people from California to Queensland.
So if you have a flood of innovators from Silicon Valley coming for vacations or other reasons... one question is, what role does education play in your current innovation agenda? How are you looking at education as a piece of the $180 million Advanced Queensland effort?
Okay, so we have a separate policy called Advancing Education, and one of the key drivers there, I'm actually very fortunate in my position. I get to go to my schools and see what the students are studying and talk to the teachers. And it struck me that in other countries, in other states, coding is being taught in high schools, but it's not being taught right at that very early age as a separate language. So we actually have introduced the coding in at the primary school level that I mentioned previously. And just going into some of the classrooms and just to see the technology, I went to this one classroom and the year three students were actually teaching the first year students computers. The teachers weren't teaching them. The year threes knew more than the teachers. So there's this huge appetite for learning new ways. And I was fortunate to be in Japan last year, and the robotics is quite interesting. So we also are trialling some robots in our schools to teaching different languages, because the kids just want different ways of learning things. So anything new that we can trial, we're giving it a go. We're out there saying, let's try it, let's see how it goes, and let's measure it that way. But we have such a large state. We have students studying as far north as Torres Strait, out the northwest of Mount Isa, small schools, School of the Air, because some people live on remote properties. So we have a very good School of the Air program where the students are going in now via computer. That's if they have access to the computers. So that's another challenge, being so remote.
And of course, with Queensland University of Technology and University of Queensland and James Cook and some of the other fantastic research institutions, you have some of the premier education in higher ed in the world.
Oh, we're just so fortunate in Queensland to have such great institutions. And if we go back to the late 90s, when the former Labor Premier, Peter Beattie, really embarked on this smart state strategy. Like, everything he did was smart state. He had number plates, smart state. Everybody in Queensland knew that Queensland was becoming the smart state. Then once he left office, there was a bit of a downturn. But what he was able to achieve was all of this money came in to building these fantastic education and research facilities. And when I came into office, I was very concerned that we were losing some of our best and brightest overseas. So that's why Advanced Queensland is about retaining our existing talent, but also harnessing new talent and new opportunities of allowing people to come into Queensland.
Now, this is the second year that you've attended the International Bio Conference, which is a major commitment by a state premier to take that time. So what is the opportunity, or some of the opportunities in bioscience, life sciences, biotech, that excite you and have caused you to invest that much from Queensland in the subject?
I think there is so much research that's going on out there, and there is so much discovery and innovation that the rest of the world needs to hear about it. And as a premier, I think the greatest thing I could do is to help communicate that message. And we know that if we can commercialise in Queensland, then that means more money in Queensland, more jobs in Queensland, and the opportunity to grow that biotechnology sector. But it's also about making sure that we give our researchers the best tools and the ability to study and go overseas. So we've got a lot of money going into research scholarships. And another area we're investing money is for women, because I was shocked to find out that a lot of women were excelling and getting medals, but then they weren't going on to that next higher level because they were leaving to have their families and their research wasn't being done. So we're actually putting money in so their research can still happen, so they can have their family at the same time, or if they need to travel, there's money available there that they can take someone with them or take their children with them. So it's about building that capacity to really ensure that our female researchers are having the same opportunities as our male researchers.
Well, you double the opportunities for your state to produce great work. Whenever you get rid of these gender impediments and hurdles, as you've been doing in the government sector. You've had now 30 years or so since the, sort of smart state strategy began. You're going back to the Beattie government. And, there have been, as you said, there have been cycles and waves. Well, maybe less than 30. We have some people in the audience shaking their
1998.
Heads. 1998. He's not that old. Yeah, Peter can't be that old. Yeah. The
15 years.
But what are the lessons learned over that time frame?
Oh, the lessons?
Yeah, lessons about what works and what doesn't work and things that you want to double down on.
Well, I think before we had Smart State, Queensland was viewed differently from around the rest of Australia. It was perceived as being a little bit conservative at times, sort of a bit focused on inwards, not looking outwards, relying always on our traditional resources. So what Smart State said to the rest of Australia is that, yep, we're ready. We're ready to drive the new economy. We're ready to be bold, to put in place these research centres and be part of the global world. And I think it has had, you know, a remarkable, like people do recognise Queensland when they come to these bio conferences. We've got 100 delegates here on this part of the trade mission, up from last year. So it's growing. And having spoken to some people who have been coming to bio for many, many years, where it started off where they have to get their own way here and find and sort of navigate, now we have the situation where people know the sectors, they know the players, and they know how to make the deals. And that's what we're seeing. And I think with modern communication now, it's much easier to do business. And our economies are open up so much that it's great to see the collaboration that's happening.
Well, you know, one of the effects of that outreach appears to be that the U.S. isn't the only place that's discovered the opportunities in Queensland. One of the questions relates to Chilean startups that apparently have sprung up in Queensland and view it as a launch pad to the Asia Pacific. Could you fill us in on that?
Yeah, so there was this program in Chile to attract startups, and it's their government would offer so much money to attract young people to move to Chile, and it actually worked. And we thought, well, hang on, if it's worked there, Queensland's a much better place to come to. So let's give it a go. And we've only just opened up the applications, and I announced that at our Innovation and Investment Summit. So that's another thing my government's doing. We're actually driving. We had our first Innovation and Investment Summit just a couple of months ago, and my whole cabinet was present at that summit because I want everybody who attended to know that my cabinet and my government is 100% behind this. So I think we're going to see a lot of commitment over the next few years in this space, and I'm looking forward to seeing that commercialisation, which has been that missing building block, happening in Queensland.
Now, you mentioned your cabinet, and I think earlier you mentioned that half your cabinet is female. I think the new Prime Minister of Canada has done the same thing. He has gender equality in his cabinet as well. Have you seen a difference in how the cabinet operates with gender equality than other cabinets that you've been in that were more lopsided in favor of men?
Yes, it is. During the election campaign, I remember one night before a major speech I had to do the next day thinking, I wonder if I can have a 50% female cabinet. And I was sort of thought, oh, that's a bit of a dream. But it actually happened and we were able to make it happen. And it is completely different. I've served in a cabinet which was male-dominated. And that's not to say that there are not good male ministers. Of course they are. But it's the way in which your voice is heard or you are spoken, your voice is drowned out. In my cabinet, every person sitting around that table, male and female, has an equal voice. And it actually encourages more discussion. There is more collaboration amongst the ministers, and they actually feel that they can come back and have, you know, a second say or a third say depending on how the conversation is going, and that's not revealing too much of cabinet confidentiality. And I might just contrast that with when I go down to our COAG meetings, which is our national meeting of the Prime Minister and all of the premiers and leaders of the territories, I am the only woman. And I feel like I've stepped back 20 years. And it is, once again, it is still a boys' club, unfortunately. They're all very respectful, but I'm often the last person to have the say, so I make sure I'm very forceful in what I say.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that you would get the last word. So I think that's a...
I always get the last word.
Yeah, that's good. For those who aren't familiar with the rivalry between New South Wales and Queensland, I think you've already foreshadowed it a little bit. But one of the questions has to do with the deepest and frankly most painful aspects of that rivalry, which is your footy contest every year of State of Origin. You have now won 9 of the last 10 contests. And you won the first night, and it's the best 2 out of 3. So when are you going to cut New South Wales a break? You know?
I don't think we're going to. It is an incredible rivalry that's been happening for many, many years. And I think it's one that's going to continue for many more. And I don't know if, for those of you in the room who have not seen a State of Origin match, you must watch it at some stage in your life. It is just, it's an incredible experience where the crowd comes alive, the whole, no one's on the roads, no one drives during State of Origin. The streets are as quiet as ever because everybody is inside watching the State of Origin match or they're at the game. But the rivalry has been going on for many, many years and the state premiers have a bet. And last year, the losing premier, which was Mike Baird, he had to wear the Queensland jersey in his parliament, in the New South Wales parliament. But unfortunately, he wore it under his suit at the very, and then took the jacket off, tore the shirt off, and underneath was a New South Wales jersey. And this year we're doing something for charity, which I think's nice, and the losing premier has to have the winning side's shirt with all the names signed on it hanging in their office for one whole month. And then it would be auctioned for charity, so it'll go for a good cause in the end.
Yeah. Well, next year I think we're going to be looking at tattoos, given the progress that's happening here.
I like that. Because yeah. the odds are on Queensland will go okay.
There it is. Ex-ambassadors making mischief. Who came up with that ridiculous idea? Well, yeah. You have painted a rosy picture of Queensland, and I have not been able to disabuse. I couldn't try to disabuse people of it because it's true. It's a beautiful, beautiful state. Got a couple minutes, and I'm going to give you a run that I've never given anyone else, which is if you want to talk about what attracted you and your family to Queensland, and what you think attracts others to it. Today, what are the things that we haven't already talked about that are the real features?
Oh well, what was interesting when my grandfather moved from Poland out to Queensland is that the boat actually went down to Melbourne, and he said, "It's too cold, I'm not getting out here." Then it went to Newcastle in New South Wales, and he said, "I'm not getting out here." And when he got to Brisbane, he said, "Yep, this will do." Lovely warm climate, but I think the greatest asset is our people, and there is something unique about living in Queensland and being a Queenslander. We have a vibrant economy. In the southeast is where the mostly populated areas are, But you can go to some of the remote parts of Queensland where there are absolutely pristine, untouched areas of vast land and beautiful rivers. We have a large Indigenous community living in some of the most remote areas of our state. We have a very vibrant multicultural community as well. We have strong resources sector, but we also have the magnificent beaches, beautiful rainforests. There is always something for everyone to do. And even out west in the outback, where I went a few weeks ago, they have discovered one of the largest remains of a dinosaur that ever walked the planet, where there used to be rainforests out in the middle of the desert. And a young boy, 15, was riding his bike and noticed something on the front of his bike, thought, I might take this to the museum next time I'm in Brisbane, went to the museum, and it was a great find. And there's going to be a publication on that within the next month or so. So my final words are, if you have not been to Queensland, you must. It must be on your must-do list, a destination, and, of course, a wonderful, welcoming community.
Well, no, you can applaud that. And I would add that the Daintree Rainforest, you go up there and just in the walk from the parking lot to where you sign in, you actually walk past more species than exist in all of North America. It's just a fabulous area of biodiversity throughout the Queensland region. I see we've also got the mayors of Sunshine Coast. So we've got surfing represented. We've got Moreton Bay, and which has the Moreton Bay bugs. And we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. And so I'm going to ask you that question. What are Moreton Bay bugs?
They are delicious. They are... If ever you're in Queensland, you've got to have a Moreton Bay bug. Years and years ago, they used to be like the bycatch that was discarded. And then now it is revered. Chefs cook it up. It's like a small lobster, if you can imagine that. And the restaurants have specialties right throughout Brisbane. And it sure is a Queensland specialty.
Well, I'd suggest you may need some help with branding and marketing, but otherwise, they sound delicious. Our special thanks to the Honourable Anastasia Palaszczuk, Premier of Queensland, Australia. I also want to thank our audience here on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Ambassador Jeff Bleich, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.